Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Larson, Judge Werke, Judge Bjorkman, the Honorable Elise Larson presiding.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the Court of Appeals. For the audio record, today is September 12th, 2024, and this hearing is being held via Zoom.gov. An audio record of today's hearing will be available on the court's website. We have four oral cases this morning and one non-oral case on the agenda today. I would observe for the attorneys that you should be able to see a time clock if you are using gallery view. Are you both able to see the time clock?
Yes,
Yes.
Your Honor.
And then I would remind you both just to mute your microphones when you're not speaking so that we don't, pick up the excess noise. And with that, I will call the first case, which is case number A24-0037, State v. Ahmed. Good morning, counsel.
Morning,
Morning,
Your
Your
Honor.
Honor.
As you both know, you'll each be given 15 minutes for your argument this morning, and appellant, you will be given 5 minutes for rebuttal. We do create an audio record, so if at the beginning of your argument you would identify yourself and your client for the record, we would appreciate that very much. And with that, counsel for appellant, are you prepared to begin?
Yes, I am.
You may begin when you're ready.
May it please the court, my name is Richard Schmitz. I represent appellant Mohammed Ahmed. There are several issues in this case, and I'm certainly willing to answer any question from this court about any of the issues raised in the appellant's brief, but I want to start with the jury instruction issue. The trial court's instruction on the conspiracy count included a separate paragraph entitled Co-Conspirator Liability. This instruction contained an expansive theory of criminal liability that is not part of the plain language of the Drug Conspiracy Statute 152.096, and it's not supported by any case law. Minnesota's Drug Conspiracy Statute, not some other statute, not some federal statute, not common law conspiracy. Minnesota's Drug Conspiracy Statute does not confer criminal liability on a defendant for all foreseeable crimes committed by co-conspirator. And the error was plain because the statute just does not contain the language that the trial court told the jury that it did. And we are talking about a criminal statute, and the trial court had no authority to change it. In fact, the instructions language is contrary to case law. It's the Kuhnau case, which the Minnesota Supreme Court interpreted Minnesota's drug conspiracy statute, specifically says that a person cannot become a party to or criminally responsible for the criminal acts of another unless he knows their true character. So the case law that has interpreted the drug conspiracy statute held the opposite of what the instruction was given. The old cases that respondent cites to in the state's brief, the federal cases, are irrelevant because they do not construe this statute. And like I said, Kuhnau, the one case that does, says the opposite. In terms of harm, the erroneous instruction allowed the jury to find Mr. Ahmed guilty of the substantive offenses in counts 2 and 3, even without a finding that he personally or jointly possessed the pills found in the bag in the closet. And because of the alleged errors were compounded and discussed in closing argument in conjunction with the prosecutorial error, we also feel like it had an impact on the conspiracy count itself. And I want to pivot then to the misconduct argument. Respondent claims in its briefing, as well as to the jury, that the state did not have to prove that Mr. Ahmed entered into an agreement intending to sell above the threshold. And this is contrary to Kuhnau as well. It is contrary to this court's DeShay case. It's contrary to this court's unpublished Chevry case. And it's contrary even to the unpublished Terrell case mentioned in respondent's additional authorities letter. In all those cases, the legal question is insufficiency challenges is described as, did the defendant and his co-conspirator agree to sell more than 10 grams? Or did the defendant and the co-conspirator agree to possess over 6 grams? Not, did the defendant and the co-conspirator agree to sell any amount? And did the case involve over 10 grams? So while the substantive offense of sale of drugs or possession of drugs might not have a knowledge of weight as an essential element, the crime of conspiracy certainly does. The state must prove that there was an intent to commit the act prohibited. Here, the act prohibited was controlled substance crime in the first degree, which has a weight threshold.
So, the state relies on the Alvarez case for why this isn't a plain error. Could you give us your argument for why the Alvarez case doesn't support this not being a plain error, since that's the standard that we're under for this particular claim?
Okay, in terms of the plain error standard, this court's decision in Alvarez was a guilty plea challenge on a factual basis. And there is a line that says that defendant need not know the amount, but it was inconsequential to the decision, and it is dicta. And moreover, that line from this court in that case cannot be reconciled with Kunal's holding, which is that the evidence of intent to commit the act that is the object of the conspiracy, aka the act prohibited, that the defendant must agree to that and intend that. So Avelis Alvarez, the language relied on by the prosecutor is dicta. It cannot be reconciled with Kunal. And all of this court's cases, when discussing sufficiency and what the state must prove for sufficiency, always frame it as the defendant and the co-conspirator agree to sell an amount above the threshold. So the dicta of Avelis Alvarez is a very thin reed to elevate the defendant's lack of intent on amount into rule of law status, and very thin.
Well, that may be, but as Judge Larson said, we're in the world of plain error now, right? I mean, anybody, defense counsel could have raised these issues at trial and could have discussed whether this was dicta or not, or a thin read or not. But to charge the, plain error here, that seems to me to be another story.
The amount of harm that's based on that, using that dicta to get a shortcut for the state is immeasurable when Mr. Ahmed's defense went to the heart of what was discussed. His primary defense was that he never intended or didn't know the extent of Mr. Farah's activities. So for the state to say
I thought his primary defense was that he didn't possess the 775 or 800 or how many ever pills were found in the closet. Am I wrong about that?
That was the defense, that he did not possess them. But under the co-conspirator liability instruction error and the state's argument that we were just discussing, that lack of knowledge was considered to be sort of a nullity. It didn't matter. It was irrelevant, is what the jury was told. So the jury went thinking that he had to sell any amount of drugs to be guilty of the top counts. And in a case where he basically conceded that he sold one pill to the Miss Allery, it was basically that argument.
I just want to make sure I understand. So for the purpose of closing argument, though, this really related to the conspiracy count, this statement, right? Not to the possession and sale counts.
It did, but it was argued in conjunction with the erroneous instruction, which went to the substantive counts. So it's all the harm is all tied in together, because the prosecutor said, you heard the judge say that he's guilty for any crimes committed by the co-defendant. And on top of that, we do not have to prove that he had an agreement for above 50 pills. So when the defense counsel made the argument for acquittal based on the fact that he had no knowledge of the pills and didn't know the extent of Mr. Farah's activities, those two errors worked in conjunction to make the defense irrelevant on all the top counts, including the conspiracy count. Now, there was an alternative defense presented, but it related to the testing issue, which is our sufficiency argument. So there was two defenses presented. The primary defense is what I just described, but the second defense didn't go to knowledge of the amount. It went to the state failed to prove the threshold because it didn't have any of the pills tested that were found in the bag.
That argument, though, I'm troubled with that argument because this seems to be exactly the type of situation that was carved out by Robinson. We're all aware of Robinson, where the packets were not adequately tested, but here you have 800 plus pills. How do you not distinguish this as the intended cutout in terms of the quantity that was examined?
Because none of the pills taken from the bag in the closet were tested. So 775 pills were seized from a bag that was different than the other pills that
okay,
were
let me just make sure I understand this. So you're saying that because out of the quantity that the pills that were specifically taken from the closet were not a part of that sample, that that's why Robinson would apply?
Correct. The pills that were tested were three. One from that was seized from the Miss Allery, one tested from the pocket Mr. Ahmed, and one from the pocket of Mr. Farah. That was it. Three pills total.
You would agree, wouldn't you, counsel, that all of the pills, including the 775 that were in the bag in the closet, were uniform in appearance? They were all looked the same, had the same imprint, same color. That's true, right? Doesn't the evidence show that, Mr. Schmitz?
It does, but we're not dealing with commercially packaged pills from a pharmacy. In all the cases where there's
commercially packaged,
No, I would say you would agree that the law permits drug identification by circumstances other than laboratory testing, right?
In certain circumstances, through extrapolation, there can be. But under Robinson, there has to be some testing done. And is there...
Your argument, Mr. Schmidt, is that, if there was just piles of blue pills, I think they were blue, as I understood, stamped M30. So you have a specificity, a marker on each of those.
Yes, the lead investigator in this case testified that his belief was that these pills were manufactured illegally in a warehouse in Mexico. Is there any assurance that illegal drug labs in Mexico never mix in placebos in their, is the state vouching for illegal operations that they don't mix in pills? We're not saying that every pill in the bag needed to be tested, just enough to have a statistical significant sampling.
The problem, what is just enough? I mean, what are you pitching in terms of just enough, half the sample? I mean, this seems to be a little burdensome, and exactly what Robinson seems to open up in terms of not having to test the entire batch.
We would concede that there wouldn't need to be testing to prove the threshold, but I think the rule of law should be statistically significant portion of the pills, or at least one. That would be something that we would propose.
Counsel, I guess that's how I understood your argument, was that this goes more into the line of cases about like separate packaging, and that here the bag in the closet was separate packaging. And so at least one pill from that batch needed to be tested to make sure that it was consistent with the ones that were collected from the individuals. Do I have that correct?
That's an accurate characterization of the argument, yes, that at least one of the pills needed to be tested.
And you would agree that this would be a different case if one of the pills had been tested in the bag, or are you arguing that more, because there were 700, more than one of those pills would have been? I just want to make sure that I'm understanding the specificity of your argument.
I think the rule of law should be statistically significant portion. However, our argument would surely be less strong if one pill had been tested from the bag and it tested positive. But in this case, none of the pills were. So it's different than Robinson, and it's different than all the other cases where there was a pharmacy involved, blistered packaging, commercial packaging. This is an illegal drug operation, at least according to the state's lead detective.
Is there any evidence that suggests the pills that were found on your client's person and on the person named Bird's person were any different in appearance, size, than the 775 pills in the bag?
No.
So isn't there a reasonable inference that, in fact, the two gentlemen on whom pills were found and the pills that were, in fact, tested got those pills out of the same bag with the other 775?
The state's evidence did not show where the pills that were found in the pockets came from. And so there would not be any assurance they were the same. And the similar in appearance argument was what the estate argued in Robinson and Carpenter. So that argument has been rejected as being dispositive in terms of the case. It might be a factor, but it's not dispositive.
Yeah, those cases relate to pills that were, you know, similarly marked the way that the pills were in this case.
No, they were street drugs. The cases that talk about commercial pills that are similar all dealt with commercial packaging. That was emphasized as a defining characteristic in this court's opinions dealing with pills, the fact that it was commercial packaging. See, I got about a minute left. I want to quickly...
One more question on this, and it's... And maybe there's not a good answer because I haven't. So it seems to me that this question, when it's been raised in the past, we've discussed it as sufficiency of the evidence, but then it seems that we've done more of a de novo review in terms of how we've reviewed the question. What is your position on what our standard of review is with regard to whether these, whether this testing needed to occur, whether this testing was proper?
I think it's a sufficiency of the evidence rule, and the standard rules of law and standards of review apply. But because I think that the facts are undisputed, that it would be akin to a de novo review because there's nothing that would be differencing to a jury or fact finder or anything like that. I see I'm out of time.
You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent, are you ready to begin?
I am, Your Honor.
You may begin when you are ready.
May it please the court. My name is Scott Bueller. I'm the first assistant Polk County attorney. I represent the state of Minnesota and the respondent in this appeal. I'm appearing from Crookston today. In the interest of full disclosure, I am confined to my home essentially right now in a wheelchair with my leg elevated in a cast. So if I appear to be uncomfortable during this argument, it's more of a physical discomfort than it is with the argument itself. Before I get into the merits of counsel's argument, there's something that I want to address that dovetails with his argument, and that is the fact that I don't believe appellant's brief in this case complies with Rule 12802 Subdivision 1C. You know, the rule is clear that an appellant's brief must, and I quote, the facts must be stated with fair with complete candor and as concisely as possible. Of course, must is mandatory. And the rule goes on to set forth the specific rule when sufficiency of the evidence is challenged. It says, the evidence of any tending directly or by reasonable inference to sustain the verdict, findings or determination shall be summarized. Again, shall is mandatory. You know, in this case, appellants raised not only sufficiency of the evidence challenge, but he's raised several issues that are reviewed for plain error. And of course, when you're reviewing for plain error, the third prong is effect on the substantial rights of the defendant, which requires an analysis of the evidence. And in this case, it was a conspiracy drug case, and the best evidence that I presented to the jury was appellant's text messages. I summarized those in detail on pages 7 through 10 of my brief. Appellant's entire brief contains one reference to those text messages when he states, several of the text messages seem to indicate that Ahmed had more knowledge of Farah's activities than he claimed during his custodial statement. That's a gross understatement. Those text messages, the step.
Yeah, I think I don't mean to cut you off, but I know you have limited time and a number of issues. And I think the panel, I can speak for all of us, we're fully aware of your position on it because you spelled it out very directly in your respondent's brief. You did not, however, bring a motion to strike the brief, correct?
Correct. No, Your Honor, I'm just responding to the arguments that were made.
Yeah. And I'd like you to begin by responding to Mr. Schmidt's argument that these jury instructions, particularly the instruction with respect to conspiracy count, are plainly erroneous, particularly in light of the Kuhnau decision, and in and of itself supports reversal in a new trial. How do you respond to that?
Well, just going to clarify, are you referring to the co-conspirator instruction? Because he also raised one instruction with regard to the conspiracy count itself with regard to an error that the district court did make.
I'm referring to the co-conspirator argument.
Well, first of all, I note that this is being reviewed for plain error. And so it's appellant's burden to prove that the district court essentially should have acted sua sponte and refused the party's agreement to, that this instruction would be given. That's a heavy burden. And as the Minnesota Supreme Court has stated, it's his burden to prove that this issue had been conclusively resolved at the time of the appeal in this case. Appellant hasn't cited any case, any published opinion in this state that says the co-conspirator theory of liability does not exist. I cited a whole series of cases going back to Barrett in 1889 up through Lucas in 1985, which was a murder conspiracy case in which Crimjig 4.04 was given. So I don't know how appellant gets around the plain error argument. Kuhnau does not address the co-conspirator theory of liability in any way, shape, or form. In fact, the error in Kuhnau was the fact that the district court refused to incorporate the substantive crime instruction into the conspiracy. And again, there was no argument made in Kuhnau about knowledge with regard to weight, with regard to the offense in that case. Counsel seems to want to extrapolate Kuhnau into areas in which it doesn't apply. I just would note that one reason that I cited United States versus Sample, a D.C. Circuit opinion from 1980 in my supplemental authorities, was the D.C. Circuit actually quoted from the Minnesota Supreme Court's opinion in Hearst an example of a state court that adopted the or was utilizing the co-conspirator theory of liability utilized by the or adopted by the U.S. Supreme Court in Pinkerton versus the United States in 1946. Just like in federal law, there is no statute that establishes the co-conspirator theory of liability. It's simply a matter of common law interpretation of part of what is involved in a conspiracy. That's exactly what Barrett was and the other cases that have addressed this issue over the years. It's not like 60905 when the Minnesota legislature enacted that statute. It established aiding liability. It also added other issues beyond aiding or other theories. And then it was important for the court to or the legislature to decide whether or not it was going to be limited to the only that crime or there was going to be expanded liability. And it adopted essentially the reasonable foreseeability test, which is exactly what the law has always allowed with regard to a conspiracy offense. So it's interesting that if you were to accept counsel's argument, Pinkerton was wrongly decided by the U.S. Supreme Court and every federal court in America has been using the wrong standard. I just would note the other supplemental authority I cited to this court recently was the Minnesota Supreme Court's opinion in Blevins, which basically said that if a court has interpreted the law and the legislature does not change that by statute, that interpretation essentially becomes a part of the law. And that's exactly what you have with regard to the co-conspirator. Lucas from 1985, when this
counsel,
exact same jury structure was given.
You froze there for a second. You might want to go back like 15 seconds for your argument.
Sorry about that. And I just wanted, what I was saying is that counsel doesn't acknowledge State versus Lucas in his brief. This is a plain error case. The district court could have easily, now I will acknowledge to this court, I wish this issue would have been raised before the district court because I would have enjoyed doing the entire history of the co-conspirator theory of liability in both this state, federal court, and state courts. But this is plain error. And essentially with Lucas on the books, I don't know how counsel can meet his burden to prove that this issue has been conclusively resolved when in fact Crimjig 4.04 was given in a murder slash conspiracy case. This is a conspiracy slash drug case. And again, counsel's trying to take Kuhnau and expand it beyond the holding in that case just doesn't hold water. Kuhnau was a jury instruction case that basically the district court failed to instruct the jury as part of the conspiracy with regard to the underlying crime. That certainly is not the case here. And I also would note that even if you were to find error in this case, it would be appellant's burden to prove that substantial rights were affected. And again, I don't know how counsel can do that given the text messages, especially that these text messages clearly establish the conspiracy between these two that was going on for an extended time period, including a recent text message where Mr. Ahmed was in the Twin Cities and was referred to what appeared to be a source for fentanyl, his sales, and of course, his false statement to law enforcement. So it's awfully hard to argue that the jury couldn't have also found Mr. Ahmed guilty of committing the crime himself. That is that he possessed with intent to sell the fentanyl pills or that he possessed them, the other two substantive counts that the co-conspirator theory of liability related to. And of course, that co-conspirator theory of liability had no impact whatsoever on the conspiracy count itself. I see I'm down to about 6 minutes or so. I did want to address, if you didn't have any further questions, I'd address the testing issue in this case. With regard to that, counsel in his argument lumped counts 1, 2, and 3 together, and that isn't proper. Count 1 was a conspiracy case. There was no requirement that the state establish that that the defendant, or in this case, appellant, had actually committed the substantive crime in order to convict him of conspiracy. This court said the exact thing in Terrell in 1996 when it said, we reject the defendant's proposed requirement of a scientific proof of weight of cocaine involved in drug conspiracy. This is a fentanyl conspiracy, not a cocaine conspiracy. But I'll just use an example. Assume for the...
this is where I'm confused. So based on your theory, why then would they have to... Why then would the state have to prove his possession or sale of the 50 grams if under the, I mean, and maybe I'm misunderstanding the state's theory, but isn't the state's theory that the co-conspirator's possession of the 50 grams was enough? I guess I'm trying to understand this. The conspiracy charge is distinct from the possession and sale for the purpose of the evaluating the weight question, but that everything sort of gets lumped together with respect to the jury instructions and the statements that were made during closing arguments. Could you just clarify that for me?
Well, I'll use the example. You know, State versus Byrd, the Minnesota Supreme Court said impossibility is not a defense to a conspiracy charge or an attempt. That is that the prosecution did not need to prove the underlying crime in order to convict somebody of conspiracy. In this case, I have to prove an agreement and ultimately that the conspiracy involved more than 50 grams of fentanyl. In this case, that the defendants were agreeing to sell that quantity. Okay, so let's assume, just for the sake of argument, that those 775 pills all were fake. The fact that appellant and his co-conspirator had agreed to sell fentanyl and that they were in possession of pills that they believed were fentanyl, and that they were purporting to sell those to others would establish that 50-gram threshold for purposes of sentencing and the scope of the conspiracy, even if it wasn't actually fentanyl that was in those pills. That's exactly what the federal courts have stated in the cases that I cited. It's the difference between proving the agreement to sell versus proving the substantive crime. With regard to the substantive crimes, that is sale and possession or possession with intent to sell and possession, clearly, it was my burden to prove that these pills met the 50-gram threshold. And with regard to that, one thing that counsel, again, left out of his brief, and I think is significant in this case.
So you're saying it would have been possible in this case to prove the conspiracy, but not the underlying substantive crime?
Absolutely.
So if they had tested the pills, for example, in the closet and they had been all placebos, you still could have proven conspiracy to sell because they thought that they were real.
Correct. Now, I will tell you that would be a much more difficult case to try to a jury and convince them. Now, one thing I did want to point out with regard to the testing in this case is why this case is
one more question about this. And this goes a little bit to my question that I asked Mr. Schmitz, which is, why doesn't this fit into sort of the separate packaging cases where, you know, normally if you have separate packages, then we would like, you know, the courts have indicated that testing the separate packaging would be appropriate. Why the fact that these were, you know, in the closet, separated from all of the actors in this case, why didn't the state have the burden to test at least one pill from that container under Robinson?
Well, because these were all identical pills, and that is exactly what the BCA analyst testified to at trial. Again, don't get me wrong. I would have preferred that testing be conducted on more of these pills. In fact, I would have preferred that they be able to test the 775 pills up to the 50 gram threshold. Just isn't physically possible.
Like a pretty small burden on the state to at least have tested one of the pills in this bag, since that, you know, seems to be what brought this to a first degree charge.
And again, I agree. I would have preferred to have that evidence at trial, but the issue here is sufficiency of the evidence. That is what the state required to do so. And I believe that Robinson, and especially if you look at Loveless, it says you can rely, the state can rely on direct evidence, circumstantial evidence, scientific testing, non-scientific testing. Some of the evidence in this case that is unique is that you have an officer who testified, Sergeant Shraga, the head of the task force, that since 2017, he had never had one of these pills that didn't test positive for fentanyl. You had two forensic scientists testify that they had never tested one of these pills, and they were testing these pills regularly, week in and week out, for years, that had never tested positive for anything other than fentanyl. And forensic scientist McGuire testified that the 775 pills in there, were visually identical to the pills that were tested. They are all small, round, blue pills bearing the imprint M30 on them. That's Bueller, what makes this unique.
Mr. Bueller, because you're almost out of time, would you comment, based on your presentation on the conspiracy, that one conviction could stand without the other, is that why the sentence in this case would stand versus it being a same offense?
That's my argument, Your Honor, and I will acknowledge this court has issued several conflicting opinions, unpublished opinions, but it has recognized that distinction in Heath, a published opinion. And the unpublished opinions, I think, are distinguishable on the grounds that this was a conspiracy that goes beyond a single point in time. That is, that it wasn't just that day in East Grand Forks. It started a month before with these two bringing pills from the Twin Cities up to the East Grand Forks area and selling them. So the conspiracy itself, as charged in count one, was a much broader time period than count two, was charged of possession with intent to sell on a single date. I see I'm just about out of my time. I want to thank you, Your Honors, for allowing me to appear today.
I do have one more question. The appellant raised that the district court erred when it entered convictions for both counts two and three. I didn't see a response to that argument in your brief. Do you agree with appellant that entering both of those convictions, the possession and sale convictions, was improper?
On the facts of this case, I believe on count three, if I recall correctly, that it required possession of 50 grams more, and count one required possession with intent that, yes, that...
Sale and count 50 and possession of 50.
Correct. But the district court did not impose sentence on count three. It was only sentences on counts one, two, and four.
He's challenging that the conviction was entered under 04, I believe, is what is a challenge in the brief. And you disagree with appellant?
No, if the conviction stands on count two, I believe count three would be a lesser included because the quantities were the same threshold charge in both counts. That's not always the same with a possession with intent and possession offense.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Schmitz, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal, and I would appreciate if you would respond to the state's argument with respect to what needed about the conspiracy charge and whether they actually needed to prove that the pills were fentanyl that were in the closet.
In terms of the conspiracy count, there is not a requirement that the defendant possessed any pills. There is a requirement for an agreement plus an overt act. So if the state could charge and convict somebody for conspiracy and have no pills. However, we strongly disagree that their thresholds didn't matter in terms of the intent and the agreement of Mr. Ahmed. And, Mr. Bueller questioned my integrity. I will say the brief complies with the rules. The text messages don't discuss amounts. They are not pertinent to the legal issues raised in the brief. We didn't challenge the lesser includeds that were he was found guilty of. We discussed the counts that had thresholds. So the text messages don't discuss thresholds amounts. I've summarized them. People summarize facts in evidence all the time. I was up against a word limit. The material facts pertinent to the issues raised in the case were presented in the appellant's brief. It does comply with the rules. In terms of the sentencing issue, this is a possession with intent case. So and this goes back to the state's insistence that the drug conspiracy statute does not have an overt act requirement. Kunau says the opposite. 20 years of case law from this court citing to Kunau say the opposite. Once there's an acknowledgement that there's an overt act requirement for the drug conspiracy statute, the crime is not complete until you have an overt act combined with the agreement, not just the agreement alone.
Isn't the overt act here your clients traveling to the Twin Cities ostensibly to pick up the drugs?
The state.
I mean, there's evidence of that. I mean, wouldn't that be, if believed by the jury, the overt act?
I think the state's evidence was different. I don't think there was any evidence about when the 775 pills were acquired. So because this is a possession with intent case, the possession and the conspiracy, the overt act of the conspiracy was acquiring the possession, are the same act. If you took a Venn diagram, the conspiracy, overt act, and the substantive offense are completely covering each other. There's no difference. That's what makes the difference in all the cases discussed in respondent's brief, where there's separate offense, the conspiracy is completely separate than a distinct sales offense and or a distinct manufacturing or distinct importing. This case, the two completely overlap.
So the same criminal objective. I mean, that's basically your argument.
The same criminal objective, because it's to make money by selling illegal drugs. It has the same place, the apartment. And it has the same time, because the drugs were acquired at some point, and that would have overlapped with the overt act for the conspiracy. So the omission of the overt act in the respondent's brief is the key to understanding the sentencing issue and a lot of the claims that the state makes in this case.
This case from the, I think it's Heath case and Gonzalez case that the state cites.
Heath involved manufacturing and then I think either a later possession or sale. So there was an agreement. The overt act was purchasing the materials to make the methamphetamine. That was the conspiracy. The later possession of the drugs occurred at a time later. So they were not the same in terms of timing and place. But if the court would just focus on the fact that this was a possession with intent case, the sentencing issue makes, from our perspective, makes sense. If this court would acknowledge the overt act requirement, our sentencing argument makes sense as well. Blevins is the opposite scenario as far as respondent is trying to use it for. We're talking about a state statute. Blevins, there was cases after the statute that interpreted the statute, and then there was no corrective legislative action. And then Blevins says, well, that's part of self-defense. Here, respondent cites to cases prior to the enactment of the drug conspiracy statute to say that Blevins controls in that scenario. We don't have cases interpreting the drug conspiracy statute other than Kunau. So all the old cases don't interpret the statute. The federal cases interpret federal statutes. So Blevins actually is the opposite scenario from what happened here. I see I'm out of time. Thank you.
Thank you very much, counsel. And thank you to counsel and both counsel for your arguments in this matter. This case has been submitted, and we will issue an opinion in the time period prescribed by statute.